Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and a warm welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. On today's programme, we look ahead to the Paralympic Games with a seasoned sports journalist.
I think running through all my writing on the Paralympics is that there's a duality. You are writing about top-level sport with people at the forefront of their own physicality, but at the same time, you're often telling the story of how they got there.
Also on Inside Europe, Greek authorities launch a crackdown on illegal immigrants, how Ramadan highlights the religious divide in Turkey, and we go on a hunt for halal delicacies in Paris. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Like many people, I've been glued to the TV over the last couple of weeks, watching the superhuman strength of the athletes competing in London. We may have to wait another 4 years for the Olympics to come round again, but it's not the end of the sporting spectacle. The Paralympic Games get underway at the end of August, and they promise to be just as compelling. I asked seasoned sports journalist Gareth Davies, who works for Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper, what it's like to cover the two events.
Paralympics, the way Paralympics is written about, what it stands for is about perception. Yes, I'm at the Olympics at the moment and, you know, covering all the combat sports at the Olympic Games. And it's, as you say, there's been superhuman efforts at the Games. But in many ways, the Paralympians themselves are the superhumans because they are the ones who are, in many ways, doing actually more extraordinary things. And I don't know whether it's just me, and I don't know whether it's because I bought into Paralympics as soon as I saw it in Atlanta in 96, and I felt this well of interest and fascination with it. But I just write in the same way about Paralympics as I do Olympics. But what I would say is there's just one difference in that I think running through all my writing on the Paralympics is that there's a duality. You are writing about top-level sport with people at the forefront of their own physicality, but at the same time, you're often telling the story of how they got there.
And there are some incredibly compelling narratives emerging from Paralympic athletes. Would you say also that the atmosphere is different for journalists covering the event? I mean, are Paralympic athletes perhaps more approachable from your point of view?
I think the Paralympians today, even though this is the first commercial Paralympics, really, the first truly commercial Paralympics we'll ever have witnessed, I think they're closer to the kind of Corinthian ideal, if you like, the amateur ideal of what sport's all about. And I think there's a naiveness, an innocence almost about Paralympic athletes, because for many of them, you know, coming to a big Games is the first time they've been in front of lots of journalists in a mix zone, 80,000 in a stadium, sold out arenas. And I think what happens as well in that moment is great sports people, people that love to show off and perform and break records and, you know, and get the baskets through the hoops from their wheelchairs, that the I don't know, it's the super ego or the super id expands in front of big crowds. And that's why we see so many records broken at the Paralympics as well every time it comes around.
You're talking there about the history of the Paralympic movement. How has the coverage also changed over, say, the last couple of decades? I believe you've been following the movement since the 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, I used to do a regular column in the Telegraph that used to be called Disabled Sport. And one of the big changes about 5 or 6 years ago is that the headline now for the section, it's no longer Disabled Sport, it's Paralympic Sport. And I think that's semantically, I think that's fascinating because, you know, I know that the head of the Paralympic movement, Sir Philip Craven, he calls it the D word because, in fact, these guys aren't disabled. It's just accessibility issues they have or, you know, impairment issues which they need to get around with a different system. That's the biggest change in many ways, is that certainly from my perspective, I don't see the people involved as disabled anymore. It's kind of like when you open the curtains on that world, there's no coming back. But at the same time, I've found that over the last 20 years, it's actually enriched my life as a human being, being involved with the Paralympics. that it makes you look at our society in a different way and perhaps makes you study your own humanity as well.
You're obviously talking from a British perspective because you're writing for a British newspaper. How does the media coverage change when you go to other parts of the world? Is there this same level of fascination with the Paralympics?
I think there's whenever I go to a Games, it's almost like a family coming back together again. There's a small group of journalists from each country who've all been struck in... I don't want to say it's a spiritual thing, but almost struck in a very deep way by the meaning of this great sports festival. And yes, we're still journalists. We still write the very hard news stories. You know, I've taken the International Paralympic Committee to task on things. But what we also witness at the Paralympic Games is quite a lot of sharing of stories. You know, a South African journalist will tell me a story about Oscar Pistorius. A Dutch journalist will tell me a story for a bit of background or colour on Esther Vergeer.
Don't usually do this.
And they don't normally do this. But it's weird. It's like we become an international brigade for the greater good, I think.
That was Gareth Davies of the Daily Telegraph speaking to me there from London. Well, we all know by now that Greece is in the grip of a financial crisis, but the country also faces another problem. It's long been one of the main entry points into the European Union for illegal immigrants from Asia and Africa, and the authorities are struggling to cope. The government has launched a crackdown on illegal immigration and detained 1,600 people in Athens. Mark Lowen has more.
Greek police have been conducting the largest operation against illegal immigrants for many months. Codenamed Operation Zeus, the sweep focused on the Greater Athens area. Over 6,000 people were rounded up. Around 1,600 of them were arrested for being without the necessary papers. The Greek police said all those arrested would be deported to their countries of origin. The first group have already been sent back to Pakistan. Immigration has become a populist issue here. As Greece sinks deeper into its financial crisis, many Greeks have hit out at immigrants, who they believe are a drain on their already struggling country. It's become a symbol of how this nation has changed. In the recent election here, the virulently anti-immigrant Golden Dawn Party, often labelled neo-Nazis, won enough votes to enter Parliament for the first time in its history. Anti-immigrant violence has increased sharply, and the government has made tackling illegal immigration one of its key priorities. The Citizens Protection Minister talked of an invasion of immigrants, saying it was perhaps a bigger problem even than the financial one. Greece's social fabric, he said, could start to unravel. But the left-wing parties have hit back, calling this operation racist and a flagrant breach of human rights. They believe Greece is simply looking for a scapegoat, an easy target of blame, and that the government is playing into the hands of the ultranationalists. Greece has little history of immigration. The first migrants arrived here in the 1990s from Albania, and mass waves from developing countries have come mainly in the past decade. Now 80% of all migrants to the EU pass through Greece, and the authorities here have already quadrupled the number of guards on the Greek border with Turkey in case of an influx of refugees from Syria. Greece has long argued that it unfairly takes the strain of illegal immigration into the EU, and that it's too much for a small country to bear, let alone one mired in its worst recession since the Second World War. Mark Lowen, Deutsche Welle Radio, Athens.
I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn, and you're listening to Inside Europe. In Turkey, the Islamic fasting month of Ramadan is a testing time for the country's large Muslim population, especially this year when it falls in the height of summer. It also highlights the often uneasy division between the country's secular and religious communities, nowhere more so than in Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, famed as much for its bars and nightlife as its mosques. That tension erupted recently when the authorities banned alcohol at an international rock concert. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The The pious and the secular clashed head-on in Istanbul at a recent international rock concert at Bilgi University. The all-day event was sponsored by Turkey's leading beer producer. But a last-minute decision resulted in a ban on alcohol. Thousands of parched rockers had to make do with lemonade and water instead. The concert was held in the Eyüp district of the city, which has a large religious community, where Ramadan is strictly followed. The local authorities, dominated by the ruling Islamic-rooted AK party, defended the ban, citing the religious sensitivities of the locals. In the Eyüp district, there are mixed feelings about the ban.
People in the neighbourhood organised a petition to stop alcohol being sold at the concert, but I didn't sign it because I don't believe you should interfere in other people's lives.
This is a predominantly Muslim area, so the ban was necessary, out of respect for us.
İnan Çelikke is a local member of the pro-secular main opposition People's Republican Party. He sees the restrictions as a thin end of the wedge and says drinking is being driven underground in places like Eyüp.
Neighborhood pressure by religious people and the religiously controlled local authority is having a growing effect on secular locals. It's pushing people to drink illegally in the back of shops.
The controversy has gone national. The devout Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose AK party is Islamic-rooted, has proudly declared that he was behind the decision to ban alcohol at the concert, claiming he was protecting the young.
Bu noktada alkolik bir genç olarak yetişmesinden yana değilim. Restoranlarında.
The concert organizers want our youth to be alcoholics. What on earth is this? I told the university authorities we were upset over the festival. For Allah's sake, how can this occur? Can anyone allow alcohol to be sold on a school campus? Students can go and drink in appropriate places. It's not like we're shutting down bars.
Istanbul is home to some of Islam's most important mosques. But it's also famous for its vibrant nightlife, and there are bars and restaurants that date back centuries. The Meyhane, for instance, where numerous tasty tapa-like dishes are served accompanied by the national drink of rakı, a potent aniseed spirit. But Gürkan Tan of Bilgi University worries that the delicate balance of the city is changing.
First, Üsküdar district. The mayor told that we are not going to sell alcohol. Then we see other places, especially in Beyoğlu. It's an entertainment area. We started to see the very same thing. They don't tell it directly, but your right to drink alcohol in public places is diminishing. And these are the municipalities of the ruling party.
It's becoming increasingly difficult to find a drop of the hard stuff in areas of the city under the control of the Islamic-rooted AK party. But in neighbourhoods controlled by the centre-left party, there's been an explosion in the number of bars and in particular meyhanes. In the Kadıköy district, which is ironically on the Asian side of the city, dozens of bars and restaurants have opened in the space of a year. People sit drinking and eating day and night, even during the holy month of Ramadan. And there's an awareness the city is changing.
It's 25 kilometers from here to where I live, but I can't drink in my neighborhood, so I come all the way here for alcohol. Does that make sense to you?
A well-known Islamist columnist suggested early this year that secular and religious people should live in separate quarters of the city. But Tan of Bilgi University says that's a depressing prospect.
We feel that our lives are divided into parts. I mean, this is your area and this is your area. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. Because we are all same people. We can have different feelings, different beliefs and different lives. But we live in the same city. Why should I restrict myself with only my neighborhood?
Istanbul is home to over 15 million people. That's nearly a quarter of the country's population. And in many ways, it's a reflection of it. If voluntary segregation replaces tolerance, That could be a worrying sign, not just for the future of Istanbul, but all of Turkey. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Well, Muslim communities elsewhere in Europe are also observing Ramadan right now. France is home to Europe's largest Muslim population, and the Holy Month is a time when many seek out special foods to break their daily fast when the sun goes down. That's partly why halal foods, which adhere to strict Islamic dietary laws, are soaring in popularity. Lisa Bryant takes a tour around the halal market in the Paris suburb of Livry-Gargan.
Saturday morning shopping at Cora Supermarket in Livry-Gargan, a gritty multi-ethnic town north of Paris. One aisle gets special attention. It's bursting with halal products, from milk, spices and candies to frozen lasagna and hamburger meat. It offers a one-stop shop for Muslim consumers. There's even the halal version of France's trademark delicacy, foie gras, which 39-year-old business executive Munira Ben Mamar adds to her shopping cart.
10 years ago, the French Muslim community went without a lot of products because there wasn't much available. Today, manufacturers realize they have a several million euro market and that Muslim consumers have a lot of purchasing power.
Cora director Mathias Michonneau agrees. He estimates halal sales are growing at more than 10% a year.
Dès lors qu'on enrichissait l'offre, qu'on balisait les produits, qu'on les animait par des...
As soon as we began improving what's on offer and promoting the products, the clientele responded. That also encouraged more variety and the space we're dedicating to them, even if we haven't completely responded to our clients' demands.
Isla Delis, fièrement halal.
Halal manufacturers like meat company Isla Delis are also seeing double-digit growth. For the first time this year, it launched this Ramadan ad on primetime TV. At stake, a Ramadan market worth about 350 million euros, according to Abbas Bendali, head of the Paris-based Solus market research firm. Not only are more and more of France's 5 million Muslims buying halal, he says, but more are also observing the Muslim fasting month. Their tastes, however, vary widely.
Les jeunes qui vont être plus actifs, hein, donc qui travaillent.
Younger Muslims are more active, they work, they're more urban, they're more likely to want pre-prepared foods, world cuisine, everything that can be consumed rapidly. This is compared to their older counterparts, who will be more likely to eat more traditionally and prepare their food at home.
Business executive Ben Mamar is a case in point.
Moi, je suis une femme qui travaille, j'ai pas le temps de cuisiner.
I'm a working woman and I don't have time to cook, at least not every day. So I choose products that are easy to prepare. Meat, sausages, ready-cooked dishes.
Among some non-Muslims, however, halal foods spark suspicion and sometimes downright hostility.
23% de la viande est dans nos supermarchés sans étiquetage et nous mangeons halal sans savoir. Imaginez
l'inverse. Est-ce que c'est mauvais pour la santé, halal?
During the French presidential campaign this year, far-right candidate Marine Le Pen claimed many French were buying halal meat unknowingly. She suggested that Muslim slaughtering practices were unhealthy and cruel to animals. The quick hamburger chain has also generated controversy by using halal meat for its Muslim customers. Market researcher Bendali.
C'est vrai que ça a heurté les musulmans de France. Sur un plan économique,
this controversy hurt many Muslims in France. It was pretty shocking, and we see it recurring during the election season. I think it put the brakes on a certain number of projects and launches. However, during this Ramadan period, I think the debate has diminished.
Today's halal controversy is about choice. Clients like Ben Mamar say there is still not enough variety and the prices are too high. But as the market scrambles to meet the spending clout of Muslim consumers, their halal demands will likely be met sooner rather than later. Lisa Bryant, DW, Livry-Gargan, France.
Staying in France, since François Hollande and the socialists took power in May, satirists have been missing the flamboyance and glamour of former French President Nicolas Sarkozy and his wife Carla Bruni. But the couple were in the news again this week when a statue to the former First Lady was unveiled in a suburb of Paris. John Lawrenson has this postcard.
It was always a weird idea. A 7-foot bronze statue of the former First Lady of France, Carla Bruni Sarkozy, dressed as a factory worker. And now France's newest monument is causing embarrassment to the Sarkozys, just as the ex-president is trying to start his political comeback. The statue was the bright idea of one Jacques Martin, the mayor of a Paris suburb called Nogent. Why exactly Mr. Martin thought it was a good idea to get Carla Bruni Sarkozy to model as a plumassière, a 19th century preparer of feathers for the fashion industry, is a mystery. But the former First Lady went for it, dressing up in a headscarf and smock to pose for the sculptress. Critics have brushed aside the idea that Carla, being Italian, was a good model for the feather women because they were often Italian immigrants like she is. But, as critics have pointed out, they're not really the same sort of immigrants, not quite the same profile, not quite the same start in life, a really quite different CV. Carla's from one of the wealthiest Italian families, became a successful fashion model and singer-songwriter, and has courted, not to use rougher language, a list of men that reads like several pages of Who's Who, stirring the minestrone for her screaming bambini after a long day's feather processing is not the Carla thing. Nogent's opposition socialists were already calling the statue grotesque even before it was revealed how much it cost. €82,000 was the figure that was finally revealed, the sort of money that used to hire you 20 feather preparers for a whole year, and you'd still have money left over to pay someone to clean your house. A tidy sum, in any case, half of which Mr. Martin, the mayor, thought would be covered out of local taxes. He had to backtrack on that one. The money is now all coming from private donors, property speculators, critics say. And the statue has been erected inside a private residence. The statue row comes at a bad time for Nicolas Sarkozy. Investigating magistrates and police raided his home at the beginning of the summer looking for evidence that he received illegal cash donations from the billionaire L'Oréal heiress Liliane Bettencourt to fund his successful 2007 bid for the presidency. Sarkozy and his UMP party are accused of having turned a blind eye to Bettencourt's tax dodging in return. A court case against the former president is now a real possibility, just as his predecessor Jacques Chirac had to stand trial at the end of his term of office. Sarkozy's response was to disappear for a month with his Italian immigrant feather-processing wife. But this week he was back, and not only looking casual on the Côte d'Azur at the feather preparer's summer residence, but back in Paris in a suit and tie, waving his arms about on television and informing the world that he'd just spent 40 minutes on the telephone with a Syrian opposition leader. Sarko, it would seem, is on his way back. Those of you who thought you heard him say a couple of months ago that he was giving up politics for good should not be surprised. In some countries, when politicians get voted out of power or are sacked from ministerial positions or get put on trial for corruption, they give up. French politicians are made of sterner stuff. Like French rock stars, they just go on and on. They may do what they call a crossing of the desert, a tramp across the sandy wilderness that lies outside elected office, but the French no more believe that Nicolas Sarkozy will retire from politics than they believe his pop star friend Johnny Hallyday when he announces a farewell tour. But it is high time Mrs. Sarkozy gave up industrial feather preparation. She's got so many better things to do. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn.
We'll be right back.
This is Inside Europe and I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn. Over the next half hour, why the revolution in Serbia has failed to live up to young people's expectations. The journalists purged from Spain's state broadcaster.
These journalists are being effectively sacked and then they're being replaced by a number of figures who are seen as much more friendly to this conservative government.
And lighting up in Prague, why the Czech Republic is seeing a boom in smoke-free cigarettes. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Serbia could end this year with the highest unemployment rate in Europe at nearly 30%. That's according to a leading group of economic analysts. The country is struggling to boost its productivity levels, and all the time the number of those out of work is growing. Perhaps the most disillusioned group in Serbian society are young people. Many feel disappointed in the pro-democracy movement, which they feel has failed to reform the country since the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. Some people have given up on a future in Serbia, opting instead to move abroad. Sasha Pavey reports.
It's a Sunday night in the historic district of Skadalia in Belgrade. Musicians line the cobblestone streets and the old-style kafanas and bars are filled with out-of-work young people. Most live at home and rely on their grandparents' pensions for pocket money. Many of them are among the young generation of activists who were instrumental in bringing down Milosevic in the year 2000. Now, since the Nationalists' election victory this year, this same generation is questioning whether or not they failed in their mission or whether a revolution in Serbia ever really happened at all. Simon Simonovic is one of those young people. An active and outspoken member of the student movement from the mid-1990s, Simonovic knows what it means to pay the price for one's beliefs. Thanks to his activism, he's been arrested twice, suffered beatings by nationalist skinheads, and been banned from joining any political parties. Now he conducts bike tours around Belgrade for tourists. Over Turkish coffee in his Belgrade apartment, I ask Simonovic where he thinks the 2000 revolution went wrong.
I think the roots of the problem was that coalition in 2000 was too wide and only point of agreement was that Milosevic must be put out of the power. And from the moment that happened, everybody started to fight over parts of his kingdom. We see that again violence is becoming the way of communication. That corruption become the way of living. So actually, where did it get so wrong? I'm not sure, but probably in that 6 October, there wasn't any joint strategy in which ways Serbia must go.
Unlike the year 2000, there is no united, independent student movement in Serbia today, and there is a crisis of leadership in the activist community. According to Simonovic, it's a sense of political apathy amongst his generation, who face unemployment and systemic corruption, that resulted in the Nationalist Party election victory in May this year.
Actually, I wouldn't say that people are too tired, but I don't see the new strengths who will lead now. A lot of people were misused, they're disappointed, and they're becoming more and more nihilist. But then it was clear who is on what side. Then everybody knew what is Milosevic, what is his idea, and everything was clear. But now we have he is a spokesman from that period who represents himself as the pro-European politician. We have all a range from softer to hardest nationalists who representing themselves also as pro-Europeans. We have European Union who is supporting new government and new leaders. So it's very hard to find hope and to find motivation because people are tired out after all that.
Serbia is also suffering from the brain drain phenomenon. Educated young Serbs are leaving the country in droves in search of better economic opportunities in places like Australia, Canada and the US. According to domestic figures, nearly 30% of graduates intend to pursue careers overseas. Those who remain face unemployment or succumb to Serbia's other economy, the grey market. Illegal trading activities here account for one-third of overall trade. With figures like these, it's not hard to find a young person with a university degree who works off the books. Saša Ivanović, not his real name, is a graduate of the University of Belgrade. The official average wage here is at most 340 euros a month. But on the grey market, Ivanović says he's earning 400 euros a month. Although he works 10-hour days, often 7 days a week, and has no health insurance or retirement fund. Still, he says he's one of the lucky ones in Serbia.
Obviously, because of the very bad economic situation in Serbia, people don't see that somebody can change here. So they don't see the future. So they just decide to leave.
Increasingly, companies in the US and China are looking to Serbia as a source of cheap, educated labour because young graduates here are willing to work longer hours for less money.
It's like outsourcing because we still have good, educated people who can't survive with the money in Serbia. So it's a big opportunity even for them to make some jobs here. And maybe it's like a big opportunity for the Serbia because we are not so developed a country and we still have pretty good education.
Ivanović spent 1 year studying and working in Australia. For many students here, studying abroad represents perhaps their one opportunity to find work so that they won't have to return to the Serbian job market.
So, Uroše, we're first going to listen to a conversation between a student and a university advisor.
Okay,
are you ready?
Yeah.
Now then, Mr. Bigstad, how can I help you?
Well, I'm thinking about transferring, but I'm not sure. I was hoping you could help.
Nevena Jovanović was born in Belgrade, but was raised and educated in the United States. She's since returned to Serbia to start her own tutoring business. Her clients are those Serbian students who are desperate to find placements in U.S. universities. Unlike most of her Serbian peers, however, Jovanović sees economic opportunity in her country of birth.
I think that there are opportunities everywhere. It's just a matter of going to find them. I think that a lot of people in Serbia have been raised with the mentality that if they finish university, they can be the next managing director of the next largest company, which isn't exactly accurate. And so there's a false perspective of what an appropriate job is in Serbia. But I do think that there is space on the market for companies to open and to grow.
Contrary to the views of Serbs her own age, Nevena Jovanović doesn't believe that the endemic corruption lamented by Serbs is a barrier to employment.
Not really, because I feel like corruption occurs globally, not just here. I mean, here the corruption that occurs, it's very much like anywhere in the world. It's who you know, and it's no different than finishing the top university anywhere in the world and then looking for a job and then you looking at the alumni list and then being hired at a company because you're an alumni of the same school as the director. I mean, that's the same type of thing. You're not being hired based on your knowledge. You're being hired off of who you know, who you have contact with. So I think that people maybe blow the corruption thing kind of out of the waters. Yes, it's a problem, but I don't think that it's what stops people from being successful. It's just an excuse on a laundry list of reasons not to get anything done.
Serbia was given European Union candidacy status in March this year, and while it has sworn to move towards EU integration, many believe the new government has too many old faces and that its views remain firmly in the past. In many ways, it will be the youth of Serbia who largely determine the country's future. Sasha Pavey, DW, Belgrade.
Well, one country that's gone to great lengths to come to terms with its history is Germany, which is littered with public memorials to its Nazi past. But in private, the Holocaust is still a taboo subject. Many are met with a wall of silence when they ask what their parents or grandparents did during the Third Reich. But others have managed to piece together the truth by combing through archives or rummaging in the attic. And who better to share it with than the relatives of the victims? An organisation called One by One promotes dialogue between the descendants of Holocaust victims and of Nazi perpetrators. Alexa Dvorsen went along to one of their sessions. Here's her postcard from Berlin.
Imagine growing up in a household where the unspoken rule is, don't ask about the past, ever.
Imagine that message is so powerful that it never even occurs to you to raise a question. But with time, puzzling gaps of information become too troubling to ignore. Harmless-sounding phrases in conversation turn out to be code for horrific family secrets. Inexplicable panic attacks, or in some cases, nightmares, take their toll. Then an unearthed photograph of a family member in uniform shows insignia that hints he was no ordinary soldier or policeman. Research reveals he was part of a special battalion involved in mass murder. How do you reconcile that with your love of this man you might have called Daddy or Grandpa, who took you on your first bike ride and gave you presents at Christmas? How do you deal with the shame of those deeds and his silence about them over half a century later? Priscilla Schneider came from the U.S. to participate in the one-by-one dialogue group. When she heard such narratives from Germans struggling to come to terms with their family histories, she looked them respectfully in the eye and said, "You're the reason I'm here." Born to Holocaust survivors in Budapest and raised in California, Priscilla had for decades wondered about the people whose countrymen murdered many of her relatives in the 1940s. How did they feel about the past, and what were they doing about it? As 10 of us told our stories one at a time, Priscilla discovered she had more in common with her German counterparts than she expected, because she too grew up in a climate of silence. She didn't even know she was Jewish until she was 14. It was only later that she learned her mother narrowly survived brutal beatings by Nazi soldiers in Hungary. Her father's parents were killed. Her aunt survived Dr. Mengele's torturous experiments in Auschwitz. "My family thought I was insane to come to Germany," she said, "but I feel like I'm moving forward." For Martin Buchler, a German history teacher, the dialogue group provided space for trust and tears. Raised by his father after his parents divorced, Martin had always regarded him as a man without a past, until discovering, long after his dad died, that he was part of a battalion that killed tens of thousands of Jews in Ukraine. Without knowing his father's precise role in that unit, he felt burdened with this new knowledge. What he did know was that he wanted to reach out to the other side. As an experiment nearly 20 years ago, Harvard researchers brought together descendants of Holocaust survivors and those of Nazi perpetrators. For most of them, the thought of sitting in the same room was daunting and scary. But by the time the meetings were over, they realized they weren't finished with their conversation. They had much more to say to each other. That was the beginning of One by One. Martina Emma, a German psychologist who was part of that first encounter, has served as facilitator for the dialogue groups ever since. She's joined by filmmaker Sasha Schneider, whose father lost well over 100 relatives in Latvia. With branches in Boston and Berlin, members have included Holocaust survivors, former members of the SS and Hitler Youth, bystanders, and descendants of resistance families. One by One's stated aim is to transform the legacies of conflict, war, and genocide through dialogue. It's not about forgiveness, and it's not easy work. But deep bonds can form during such intense exchange. That was the case in our group. The youngest participant was a 22-year-old Bostonian whose grandmother survived two concentration camps. The oldest was a woman born during the war while her father served in Hitler's army. While no two stories are ever the same, they sometimes intersect or mirror each other in profound, haunting ways. Miraculously, there's sometimes even room for laughter, all the more precious in this backdrop. Beyond Germany, a branch of One by One is being set up in Guatemala. The dialogue model has also been applied in Bosnia and Peru, and a similar one exists in South Africa at the Institute for the Healing of Memories. Our group visited the house of the Wannsee Conference, where the Nazis' plans to exterminate Europe's Jewish population were mapped out in 1942. Mass killings had already begun the year before. And in the museum's library upstairs, I was directed to a thick volume listing the victims of Nazi massacres in Lithuania. That's where I found the names of my grandfather's siblings and their children, Aaron, Rachel, Meir Chaim, Otniel, Itabel, Tzvi, and Sarah. After more than 25 years of telling other people's stories around the world as a correspondent, I had a rare moment to share one of my own in our group the next morning. As the week ended, participants said they were moving beyond sadness, frustration, and confusion, and leaving with hope, inspiration, and gratitude for being heard and bearing witness. We've re-entered our daily lives now, but the dialogue continues. Alexa Dvorsen, DW, Berlin.
In Spain, a number of well-known journalists have been dismissed from the national radio and television network, RTVE, apparently for criticising the government's austerity measures. The purge has prompted criticism from Reporters Without Borders, which is concerned that Spain's state media is being turned into what they call a political battlefield at the expense of the public's right to balanced news. I'm joined now by our correspondent Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Guy, how well known were the journalists in question?
Well, I mean, these journalists who are being replaced at the moment over the last few weeks at the top of RTVE are pretty much all some of the most high-profile journalists in Spain, certainly at a broadcast level. I mean, you know, they're the faces of the news. Some of them are known for high-profile interview programmes in the morning. Others just are behind the scenes, such as the head of RTVE, Fran Llorente, who was replaced. So, you know, the people who are being replaced are very well-known indeed. And so this is attracting a good deal of attention.
And what actually happened to them?
Well, if you go back to the spring, what was the new government of Mariano Rajoy changed the way that the senior personnel at RTVE are appointed, basically making it easier for the government in power to make those appointments on its own. Now, especially a government such as the current one, which has a majority in Congress, can really decide to a huge extent who's going to be presenting the news, controlling the news at RTVE. And in the wake of that change, the government has started to implement changes accordingly. It has replaced a number of high-profile journalists. So this seems to be an ongoing process. And these journalists are being effectively sacked. I mean, many of them are saying they have been effectively sacked. And then they're being replaced by a number of figures who are seen as much more friendly to this conservative government, or who have even worked in RTVE previously under conservative governments.
So it sounds like the government has quite considerable control over the state broadcaster. Are journalists able to hold politicians to account at all?
Well, I think the answer is they are able to, but in Spanish culture, it's quite unusual, particularly on the radio and on television, for journalists to really give politicians a hard time compared to many other countries. You know, it's not very common to see a journalist really grilling a politician about an issue, or particularly about their personal finances or those kind of issues. And when a journalist does do that, and it has to be said, some of these journalists who have been replaced or sacked recently are known for that kind of approach to journalism. But when they do, there can often be a big controversy. When they take that line of questioning, for example, in an interview afterwards, they're often criticised a great deal, either by politicians or people on the internet. So, you know, Spain's a country which isn't used to that kind of journalism, that kind of combative journalism between the journalist himself or herself and a politician or a public figure. So, I mean, the answer is, you know, they are able to tackle politicians or public figures in that kind of way, but it's not very common.
That was our correspondent Guy Hedgeco there, talking to me from the Spanish capital, Madrid. I'm Joanna Impey in Bonn, and you're listening to Inside Europe. As London gears up for the Paralympic Games, a controversial court case is highlighting the plight of those caring for disabled people across Europe. A Latvian woman has taken her case to the European Court of Human Rights after she gave birth some years ago to a child with Down syndrome. She wasn't aware of the disability when she was pregnant because the doctor hadn't ordered a prenatal screening test. Claiming that her rights were breached, she launched a legal battle for compensation. But as Geret Skelzis reports from Riga, human rights groups are up in arms.
It was just after she gave birth in 2002 that 41-year-old Laura, which is not her real name, was given the dreadful news that her newborn baby had Down syndrome. And it was only then that she found out that every woman who falls pregnant over the age of 35 falls into a category of genetic risk group. That means the doctor has to offer a prenatal screening which can detect chromosomal problems such as the Down syndrome. Laura's doctor had failed to do this, and so she lodged a complaint with the health authorities in order to get compensation, but she failed. So Laura took her case to the European Court of Human Rights. She wants around €300,000 for moral damages and as an allowance for her child. Her lawyer is Solvita Olsen.
We're basing our complaint on two articles of the European Convention on Human Rights. First, the right to respect for private life, prescribed by Article 8. In other words, the right to have a reproductive choice and to know about reproductive matters. And secondly, we think there's been a breach of Article 6 of the Convention because she was denied a fair trial.
Solvita Olsen says there is proof of malpractice by the doctor, but the evidence was not allowed in court back in Latvia. Laura, who's on a low income, now has to cover judicial expenses in Latvia amounting to more than 3,000 lats, that's €4,000. But her quest for justice has provoked an angry response from more than 20 NGOs who work with people suffering from Down syndrome. Earlier this year, they launched an online petition calling on the judges in Strasbourg to reject Laura's case. Liva Weichert from the Latvian Down Syndrome Society signed the petition.
This is the first case where a mother asks for the fundamental human right to euthanize her unborn child. And I really want to stress that we are not talking about abortion, which is right or wrong depending on one's moral standards. This is about euthanasia, which would be carried out in the last months of pregnancy.
Weichert believes people shouldn't be discriminated against because of genetic defects. And people with Down syndrome, she says, don't usually suffer mental or physical pain because of their condition. They go to school, have jobs and can live independent lives. That's a 13-year-old Victoria who has Down syndrome. She plays a synthesizer while her mother, Laimdota Landiša, helps her read sheet music at their home in Riga. Like Laura, Laimdota was 41 years old when she got pregnant.
Victoria was our fourth child and the long-awaited girl in our family. We didn't suspect any disorder because I'd had a sonogram which usually detects irregularities during pregnancy. And the doctor didn't offer me additional genetic screening.
Laimdota says that Victoria's Down syndrome came as a shock and turned her life upside down. She considered rejecting the baby but eventually decided to take her daughter home. Her husband, though, couldn't accept this decision and he left the family. Laimdota went back to work and has raised Victoria alone along with her other three children. She says it's been a rough ride.
I realized that I wouldn't be able to cope and I sought help. I joined a support group, and from early on I took Victoria to various daycare centers. But I raised her. I don't know how it is in other countries, but here in Latvia, mothers have to manage everything themselves if they want to raise children with disabilities.
Laimdota has also signed the international petition against Laura's case at the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. But she says Laura should have had a genetic screening test and that the mother should decide whether or not to abort a fetus. And that's an opinion shared by Harriet Roscoe-Mabbing, the editor of the European Journal of Health Law. She says that Laura's claim has caused an uproar over issues which are not even the essence of the case.
The court will not judge on those issues because the case is not about it. It's about informed consent, and the woman has not had her choice about taking a screening test or not. And that is personal autonomy, which is in the European Convention of Human Rights. And you shouldn't bring that in the light of abortion and the right of the disabled. That's what's disturbing me very much.
The NGOs are continuing to collect people's signatures for their online petition. And the European Court of Human Rights has only just started working on the case. The judge in Strasbourg is expected to knock his gavel on the table and deliver a verdict in a year's time. In the meantime, both Laura and Laimdota continue to do everything they can to look after their daughters. Jadars Dieozes, DW, Riga.
The Czech Republic is witnessing a massive boom in the sale of smoke-free electronic cigarettes from China. According to one recent study, around a third of the country's smokers have tried them, and many are giving up regular cigarettes altogether. They're doing so for three reasons, it seems: health, money, and the freedom to light up pretty much wherever they want. For now, that is. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
It's mid-afternoon in a busy street in Prague, and a customer in one of the capital's new e-cigarette shops is being shown a dazzling array of electrical devices, all designed to deliver that dose of nicotine without the toxic chemicals that smokers inhale with regular cigarettes. Some look like fountain pens, others look, well, just like cigarettes, really. But all of them work on more or less the same principle. E-cigarettes contain cartridges of liquid nicotine that is heated, vaporized, and inhaled, perfectly replicating the sensation of smoking. The liquids are available in a breathtaking variety of colours and flavours, from regular tobacco to coffee, vanilla, and even fruit. Some are even nicotine-free. Crucially, e-cigarettes contain none of the thousands of toxic and often carcinogenic chemicals found in regular cigarettes. And as e-cigarette retailer Peter Schmeichel told me from behind the counter of his modest e-tobacconist, a major incentive is the price.
Some of the people who come here are looking for ways to give up smoking. Others want to replace their regular cigarettes with electronic ones in order to save money. It's definitely cheaper. From our calculations, smokers can make savings of up to 30%.
So it's no surprise that stores like Petter's are opening up in streets across the country. There's also a burgeoning market in online sales, with websites and YouTube channels like this one offering advice and customer support for those interested in making the switch. But can they really be considered the safe cigarette? Many are sceptical, pointing to a lack of scientific evidence. Neither the World Health Organization nor the US Food and Drug Administration recommends e-cigarettes as an approved nicotine replacement therapy, saying the lack of clinical trials makes any such recommendation impossible. Some studies have detected the presence of toxic and even carcinogenic chemicals in the vapors, although further research still needs to be done. For veteran Czech anti-smoking campaigner Eva Králíková, the verdict is still out, particularly due to uncertainty over how much nicotine the smoker is inhaling.
The safety was never proven, and also the effectiveness concerning smoking cessation was never proved. So it's a question whether it works or not. But as a doctor, I cannot recommend it because it's not clear nicotine. The dose is uncertain. You can easily be overdosed by nicotine from the electronic cigarette. So we do not recommend it. But on the other side, the risk is near to zero compared to classic cigarettes. So it's a controversial topic.
The authorities, meanwhile, are rather behind the curve. Electronic cigarettes only hit the Czech market in any great number in the last few years, and the government is now debating whether to ban them in public places, just like regular cigarettes. That would be a major blow to those for whom the main attraction is being able to get their nicotine fix, even in a non-smoking restaurant or even on the train. And there is, of course, the question of tax. It won't be long before the finance ministry wakes up to the huge potential income for the state coffers. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
Well, that's all from us this week. Many thanks to my colleague Helen Sini and to our sound engineer Marion Kulina. I'm Joanna Impey. Thanks for joining me. Tune in again at the same time next week. Don't forget, we always like to hear what you've made of the items in the programme. Our email address is europe@dw.de. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.